I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Deborah Kimmett joins me now. She's just published Window Shopping for God, A Comedian's Search for Meaning. And in a frank, often funny book, she answers questions she's had for herself about family and faith, as well as the meaning of life. But just as much as she's shed light or insight, she's got just as many questions. It was a sidewalk preacher that she encountered 10 years ago that set her on a path to mend her relationship with her estranged brother. His terminal cancer diagnosis poses an imperative on forging their bond anew. She's also got to confront her addictions and revisits aspects of her Catholic upbringing. As a lapsed Catholic, a nominal one at that, I found the book fascinating as she looks for meaning in her life and the world around her. Deborah Kimmett is a trailblazer in Canadian comedy. She's been a guest on CBC's The Debaters for 17 years and has a regular spot in the Winnipeg Comedy Festival and Laugh Out Loud. Her previous comedy album, Downward Facing Broad, reached number 5 on iTunes. She's the author of Reality is Overrated, Outrunning Crazy, That Which Doesn't Kill You Makes You Funnier, and the play Miracle Mother, which was shortlisted for the Governor General's Award. This new book is from Douglas and McIntyre. We spoke nearly 2 weeks ago with Deborah joining me from Toronto. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, Deborah Kimmett. Ms. Kimmett, good morning.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
As I was telling you just before we started, how much I enjoyed the book. I laughed out loud several times. When you're writing, this might be a good question for a comedian because you're used to laughter. Do you find yourself, say, laughing out loud or giggling as you're, or at least a grin as you're writing?
No.
Really?
Not really, no. I think if I'm laughing, we're in trouble. because I think a friend of mine, Dan Redican, he used to be in the radio show called The Frantics, and I teach comedy, and so I went around to all these comedians before I was going to teach a workshop one day, and I said, what's your one line that you know about comedy? And he had a really good line, which is, drama is serious, comedy's deadly serious.
Mm.
So when I'm writing, I'm usually writing from a real point of truth, and then I know what to do to make it funny, which is usually there's a contrast between how serious the situation is and how either me or the narrator is behaving is where the contrast is. So, like, you're in church, you're not supposed to laugh, you're at a funeral, you're not supposed to, you're supposed to believe what whoever's giving the eulogy is saying about the dead person. There's always this weird contrast about how you're supposed to behave. And I find in that gap is where the humor comes. It also comes really close to tears. Like, for me, it's always walking that fine line, at least the kind of comedy I like. I like when it's the situation is gut-wrenchingly funny as opposed to just jokes, although I do love a good joke myself.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there are moments in here that I find incredibly funny. And then when I paused from say, chuckling, I realized that, no, that's incredibly sensible. That's a lot of truth there.
Yeah, I like walking that line. And also, I think a lot of comedians, all writers too, just all comedians and writers are the same, is that, we're kind of philosophers in a way, and so you can ponder a lot, which I really like in the, when I'm on stage, I can do a certain amount of that performing, but there's a lot more room for that, I find, on the page, because it's such a more, demanding medium on the page, because there's not you're not sitting there doing cute faces or have a good costume. You have to do everything with the page sitting there blank. And I found it really, this is my fourth book, but I think this one I became more comfortable with the medium of just working with the page and seeing what it could do and what I could do with it.
And you seem in the book, throughout the book, to bear yourself a great deal. Does that take a lot of work to get to? I mean, because you are quite candid and quite honest, and you say things that probably other people wouldn't even think about saying out loud.
Yeah, I think comedians, well, again, I think I've done a lot of, you can probably see how many thousands of dollars I've spent on self-help, but I kept them in business in the bookstore. But Yeah, I think that's just who I am. I found really in my mid-20s, when I was a young kid, I was such an exaggerator and liar. And then, I got sober and I remember one person said to me, if you tell the truth, you'll never have to drink again. And so I've kind of lived on this, like, if I'm thinking it,
yeah,
other people are thinking it. And I guess for me, you're still crafting stuff. You don't want to hurt other people while you're saying your own truth. And then also crafting, where I'm really at in the book. So when I'm 30, that's where I'm at, as opposed to when I'm 60, I'm somewhere else, which is the progress of what I keep learning throughout the book.
So when you're going through life and you're not just growing older, and you are progressing from, say, 20 to 60.
100%.
Did you feel the growth itself and the wisdom, perhaps?
Well, you're more tired. I don't know if you're wiser or just,
yeah.
I said what's really funny is I forget where the car keys are, but I also forget resentments. And, when I was 20, I'd be like, no, in 1984, you said that and Mom said that. Now I'm like, I've even gotten into bed at night and go, I think I was upset about something today, but I don't remember now what it was. So there's just delight in not remembering. But I also think, well, maybe you find this, but especially in my 60s, I just don't have as many bones to pick. I don't go to the mat for everything. Mm. I don't try to, I always thought I was going to change things, including myself. And I don't know, there's just a lot more love of myself. I obviously flip on the banana peel and, dive into self-doubt or whatever. But I don't stay there as long, which I think is good. I think that's good.
Yeah, another very wise thing that's in the book, it came from your aunt, was that after 50, the days will drag, but the weeks will fly by.
I know!
I'm 42, and I feel that, I really...
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I always go to the dentist and I go, it's been a year and a half since you've been here. I'm like, really? I thought you just did this 3 weeks ago. Yeah, she gave me that as a card. And I remember thinking, what a horrible card. Like, there was no cash. But here's the money.
Yeah.
I thought aunts would do the money up until you die. But no, but she was 100% true. I don't know if it's an old saw the phrase, but yeah.
Yeah, and so the other thing I was wondering as I was reading the book, I know the answer because I've read the book and I've met your parents through the book. I was going to ask you where your humor comes from, but it probably didn't come from either your mother or your father, did it?
Oh, my God. No, my dad was hilarious.
Oh, was he?
And my brothers are hilarious, and they bust, there's no way that you could be the most famous human being on earth and they would bust your chops about stuff. So you never get too far above your station. My dad was great. He was very, very funny. And he was a big philosopher too. So I got that opinion from him. I think my mom did things that were extremely funny to us, but it was really odd because when the grandchildren had a very different relationship with her and they would find her funny. And then her younger friends at the funeral, like my mom died about a year ago, and they were like, oh, your mother, what a card she was. And we're like, I'm sorry, you have the right, this is the Kimmett wake.
Yeah.
Like, I was thinking they maybe had got the wrong thing. Oh, your mother never failed to make us laugh in church. I'm like, what? But also, my mom, like everybody, softened as she got older. And, in the book, of course, around my brother's death, especially, she was really having a rough time, right? So there was not too much funny going on there.
Yeah, you explore the relationship with your family throughout the book, and I found that I found a lot of wisdom there because I think we all have our issues with family members as we grow up, as we get older. When you write about family, especially, and I'm talking about your parents and your siblings in this case, because I do get a great sense that as you got older, you got to understand them a little bit better.
100%, yeah.
Yeah, I do wish that realization or that whatever that is had come earlier, perhaps?
Well, yeah, it would have been nice. I don't know. I think it's sometimes, you know, I don't know. I did everything to make it come earlier. But I also think, you know, when you grow up in a big family, you've got this sort of, six kids, yeah. Two parents. You were like a team against the world, right? So, you know, don't dare insult any of us because we will take you on. But also, you know, I think because I was very much into my own head the way most people are, especially when they're in their 20s, I thought I was, you know, the freak of the family, all that. Later on, when I got more mature, I started to realize, well, they had come out of the same environment, and they had their own struggles with communication. They all wanted to be different. But, you know, when we got together, I think we just, you know, fell back into those old patterns with each other. I always said your family takes about 20 years to update their files on you. Like, you're like, yeah. You know, you do something when you're 15 and you're still called Stinky McCoy or something. Yeah, and you're yeah. like, okay, leave me alone about that one. You know, like, oh, what? Like, for me, I was always a big crier. Like, I cried. It's like, oh, even like I was 50 and they're like, you're going to cry again? And you're like, I haven't cried in front of you people in 25 years. But anyway, but when my brother was ill, what I noticed, and same when my niece was really sick and my daughter was really sick, we were those people that showed up 150% for each other. And I think a lot of that showing up for each other, there was a lot of healing that went on when you look back in retrospect. And at the same time, you know, like we had 8 people in our family. Kevin died. It was my dad died. Then my brother died. Now my mom's dead. And you go, okay, we've been cut in half now, so there's, you don't want to argue. You don't want to have that division. Even if you just get together once a year, you know, like, I kind of know who they are and who I am, and I don't go to them, you know, someone says, like, going to the bakery for a haircut. I don't go to the wrong place and want them to be somebody they're not. And we honestly have my one brother, who is, if you looked at the two of us, we're not very similar, but, you know, we're out for dinner a few weeks ago and with my kids who are in their 30s, and they're, you know, there he is giving me a wet willy, like, you know, putting a wet finger in my ear. And I'm like, what are you? Like, we're in our, I'm 66. You're almost 60. Like, come on now. But that's what was, I don't know, there's just this sort of childhood image of yourselves that you fall back into that I think that's where it's hard to, you know, you get into old patterns with them, and I guess you have to allow that healing to happen if you have enough time with people.
And it must be, I was going to say it was cool for your kids, but I mean, it must be frightening at a certain age to know or see their parent as a kid, if you will, or be around people who knew you before they knew you.
Yes, that's always interesting, too. I mean, they know my kids know my story really well, probably too much. They're like, okay, thank you. We've already heard that. But, yeah, it's very interesting because I had the book launch last week, and, you know, there's some people in their 80s that came, that went up to my son and daughter and said, we babysat you. And they're like, oh, well, that's nice. But it meant so much to them, you know, and they knew me when I was starting out as a mom. And, yeah, you just... The other part I think about updating my files with my mom is, and this is where I think I got wisdom as the book went on, but also as my life went on, I think we freeze frame our, especially with my mom, you know, she's one kind of mother. And then I found, but writing the book, I really, even if it wasn't perfect by the time she died, I wanted to update my files on her and allow her to be different than what I thought she was. And somebody the other day on CBC was asking me a question like, you know, is it hard when you hit these points in the book? Like, and I said, the hardest thing is to not write it from a judgmental place, but to really write from a, like, if you're going to give yourself all this wisdom, why don't you give your mom that wisdom? So the chapter about being in the mosque, which was very true.
I
thought, oh, I was, you know, on International Women's Day, I was talking to these women in a mosque, and I was, through them, seeing my own relationship with my own mother, because they, you know, they were a lot of new Canadians coming to the country, and I go, they had overcome so much to get where they were, and somehow it became parallel to me, like, oh, my mom really went through a lot to get to be the mother she was.
Yeah.
And to be the kind of person she was.
Yeah, that's why I found the book so enjoyable, because it's relatable on so many levels. I mean, you and me, we're different people, but I found, you know, just incredible wisdom and the relatability, I think, was what frightened me a little bit.
I was hoping to cut through that, like try to find those difficult moments where you're not at your best, and try to find both the humor and walk that fine line. Like I mentioned in the book, someone said to me, how did you pick which stories? And I said, I tried to pick the ones where there were the suddenly moments, where suddenly we were in a new reality. Suddenly my brother's sick. Suddenly I have a premature baby. As opposed to put every anecdote about my life in, but suddenly I was required to be something else. Because I think that's what happens. Like, you have these epiphanies in your life. I'm never going to do this again, or from now on, I'm going to be this person. But that only, it kind of has an expiry date. I think you're constantly challenged to be, are you going to go a little bit further? Are you going to be more curious? Are you going to lay down that pain that you keep walking around with? And I don't know about you, but I don't decide any of this on a good day. On a good day, I'm like, thanks, I got it from here. But it's a bad day. Like I always say, people don't go to see comedy and hear the comedian's great day. You're funny here when they fail. So I figured people wanted to read a book about that kind of walking that fine line between trying to be a better person and then not hitting the mark, you know?
Yeah, you know, one of the sections of the parts of the book, because you talk about this throughout the book, that I found quite profound is when you talk about death. Obviously, you talk about your brother's illness and death, you talk about your friend Danny who died of AIDS. And
that was verbatim, that story.
Yeah.
It's such a beautiful story that I'd had around me for a long time.
And we live in a culture that is not comfortable about talking about death, and you talk about being around it and how just being present, especially for Danny and your brother. Was incredibly important. Like in Danny's case, I mean, just touching him, because he said no one had touched him in a long time. That meant a great deal. So being around it as you have, do you think it's a little less mysterious or less frightening even?
Well, I'm not afraid of death. Like, I mean, I'm afraid of death. I always think I'm going to die. I'm always updating my music for the funeral. But, you know, as I said, I nearly died when I was 13.
Yeah.
And all I know, some people could call that trauma, that could be anxiety, is I really knew internally that there was death. I can't explain it. I was like, oh, you could just not be here in a minute. Now, that's a little harsh for a 13-year-old to walk around. And, you know, I was very profound. Like, we'd be having a party, and I'd be like, you know, we could all be dead tomorrow. And people are like, okay, thanks. Can we get another round? But that part, and, you know, there's some things you really have to work for in life. Like, I, by nature, have a bad temper, and I've had to work on that. But that ability to be with people when they're sick or dying, I don't know where that came from other than I think that initial experience, and also my family, they went to wakes and funerals like a hobby or something, especially the old generation.
Yeah.
They were always heading over to a wake. So when I was with Danny, it never occurred to me to be afraid. When I wrote that story, I didn't think, oh, good for me. But when I read it later on, like when I was putting this book out, I was like, isn't that weird where you get this ability that, you know, there's lots of abilities you get that you don't really have to work very hard on.
Mm.
You know, and I said, I don't mean that I tried to do hospice work. I'm not sure if I'm good with that stuff, but it doesn't bother me if someone wants to talk about what they're afraid of, if they're sick or they're, you know, they're dying or they're afraid to lose a person. I don't mean that I think it's easy, But if people want to talk about it, I find it odd that we can't talk about it, really, because it's the one thing that we can be pretty sure is going to happen.
Yeah.
But can I tell you a funny story about that?
Yeah, please.
It's not funny. You know, it's funny because, like, actual, like, I could die part, of course, I always think it'll be in the middle of a really long-winded story after, you know, I've just ordered a burger, but it hasn't come yet. That's what I'm, my biggest fear is I won't have had the burger. But it was so funny because right before the book came out, May 8th, and that day I was also doing the Winnipeg Comedy Festival, and I was in a hotel, and I was signing the book at the Winnipeg bookstore on McNally Robinson, and I had an anxiety attack that I thought I was going to die. Like, and it was so bizarre. Like, it was it must have been just anxiety from the book and all of that. So I went into the festival because they have a hospitality suite. They gave everybody some drinks. I don't drink, but they gave everybody drinks and martini shakers. And it said Winnipeg Comedy Festival on the side with gold. And I was like, oh, thank God. If I die, I can put my... they can sit me back. And I was telling one of the ladies who was doing my makeup, and she goes, honey, unless you're a shih tzu, I don't think we're getting all of you in there. But it just that broke it. Like, you know, I don't know, but it's weird. What scares me is not, I don't mean that I want to be sick or anything, but I just mean that subject matter does not frighten me. But, you know, a book being published, I'm almost like, catatonic.
So what is it like now that this book is out and people are telling you that it's a lovely book or that it's hilarious?
It's been just lovely. You know, I usually can find a way to wreck anything. Like, oh, she's going to compliment me. Oh, and you know, oh, I like your book, but it was very touching. What do you mean it was touching? Was it funny? Was it touching and funny? Like, I can ruin a good thing. But I'm not. I said, what's so interesting, I took a lot of time to write it, probably too long. But here is the weirdest thing that happened about, I don't know what any of this means, but every day when I went to write, I had a little saying next to me by Timothy Finley that said, when you write, pretend you're in bed with telling your lover a really good story. And everybody wrote to me when they gave me feedback was, oh, I felt like I was just sitting there talking to you. I felt like you and I were just cuddled up on a couch. And I went, well, I guess indirectly that intention, you know, came in through the book sort of in a way, you know. So I'm very glad. And I'm also glad I took care to take out what I didn't want to say. And there was stuff where I was judging myself or judging others. And then I was like, no, I don't want to live with that. And that's probably why it took so long, because I did take a lot of time editing.
Yeah. Well, so you know, you are in search throughout the book for meaning, the meaning of life, the meaning of all of this. As I was reading the book, I got some of the answers of why, what all this is for, right? But at the same time, I'm sure you're the same, that you came up with a few more questions about what life's about.
Yeah, I think the truth is, you know, certainly in many spiritual practices, that's the humility part, is that if you go deep into something, I think once you're really sure that you know something, then you've turned that journey into some sort of dogma, you know? And once it becomes dogma that isn't related to your heart, so, yeah, I think if you're still living and breathing and curious, there are going to be more questions than answers. And there isn't, oh my gosh, in earlier life, I just kept thinking, you know, I was going to get a certificate in the mail, kind of like, hey, you're done now. You can just to boss everybody around that isn't. And, like, I always wanted to be the boss. I never wanted to be one of many. But I find, you know, there are a lot of questions. And, of course, you know, when you go through periods, like, the book ended when my brother died. That's the end of it. So that's 8 years ago. Then, you know, COVID hit, and, you know, another form of questioning came, right? Because we had one reality, and then we didn't have that reality. We had something new that we struggled with for 4 years, things that we were secure in. And, you know, during COVID, I have to be honest, that's nothing about the book, but I felt like I had just gave up drinking. My emotions were everywhere. Everything that I knew to to be true, and I really was glad I had a deep practice by then, and my practice is to write. I do a lot of appreciation, gratitude stuff, and I walk on the beach. You know, I live in the beaches in Toronto, and that practice kept me going, but I swear to God, I was getting loony. I got a dog just so I could justify why I was talking to myself so much. But, yeah. And I remember I said the first week or two of COVID, I remember going, I just want to run in the lake. And someone said, are you suicidal? I go, no, I just want to do it for dramatic effect. Like, I just want it to stop.
Yeah.
And then, you know, that 4 years later, you were like, oh, my gosh, what if I knew then, right? But I think we're always being pushed to question. And, you know, yeah. I mean, a lot of the philosophies that I have studied, Buddhism, and is that, you know, you're always living in the question, not the answer. And I think that's scary. That's scary some days to not know what's going on. And yet we get those little glimmers when we're with our children or with our dog that we go, this is what the purpose is, right? We're,
yeah.
In the moment, we can feel that purpose.
Yeah, that's why we went through everything we went through to get to here, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't like the idea that everything's a lesson. I feel like that
yeah.
sounds like some school teachers running the show. I think it's more like it is, I'm like Descartes, it is, I think, but it is just the way it is. I don't think I would ever wish COVID on anyone or any of the ramifications, but in the small moments of COVID where I met people on the street and talked and little, I found really a lot of magical moments, but I don't think it was a lesson. Like, you know,
yeah.
I don't look at it that way. I think I actually don't know why it happened. I think that's the best sort of question, answer to anything, is I don't know yet.
So I was just telling you before we started, I grew up a Catholic, nominally a Catholic today. I have no real relationship to it, but I went to a wedding recently, as I was telling you, and I felt awfully comfortable there noticed that it had been a very long time since I'd been in a church, but not unenjoyable, I guess, I found the experience. I've always wondered how people view the idea of prayer, and I don't know why I brought up the Catholic part, but I think because, you know, all religions and even non-religious people pray. What is the purpose, do you think, of prayer? Is it to because I think the Catholics would tell us that it is to honor what we need to do, you know, or honor God, if you will. Other people use it as a, you know, the wish list or you know, the, mm-hmm. they want something out of it. Having looked at these various religions as you have and gone through everything you've gone through for this book, do you have an idea of what the purpose of prayer is?
That's such a good question. First off, when I was 20-something, I tell a story about this Buddhist woman who was an acting teacher, and she was, you know, you had to watch your breath and all that, and
yeah.
I'd say to her, well, as soon as, like, if someone told me to pray, I wouldn't do it, but at that time, she told me to watch my breath, so I started praying, and I said, I'm praying while I meditate. And she goes, Deborah, the main thing is take your comfort where you can. And she said, I'm a Buddhist, but I have said, as I lay me down to sleep, for 50 years as a Buddhist, every night I say it because it comforts me.
Mm.
And take your comfort. And I think that's what prayer is, like, where do you take your comfort? And many times in that desperate prayer of, oh, please, just don't let this happen to you, please, that never feels very great. I mean, it might help you. But a prayer of thanks, a prayer of help, a prayer of appreciation, a prayer of petition. Like, you know, I have people on my hit list, you know, people I hate on a regular basis.
Yeah.
I pray for them mainly so that I won't hurt them or me. But what happens to me through bless them, change me, that's my prayer. Bless them, change me. Sometimes I say bless them, bless me, because I don't know that I need to change. It's just they're bugging me.
Yeah, yeah.
All I notice in retrospect, when I pray for them, my attitude toward them changes. So I think there's it's more about intention. Some people would say, I prayed and I, you know, Jesus helped me. And if that's what happens for them, I say, good for you. I also think ritualistic prayers although when I did them as a child, they were so comforting, and then they didn't work anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
But sometimes a ritualistic prayer, you know, for me, like, I can be as agnostic as I like, but if I get scared, I still break into the rosary in my head. And I think we don't like to talk about it because we find that relationship to whatever that is, to the divine, very personal, and something that works for us. People often say, I don't pray, but I do affirmations. And I'm like, well, that just would be being a really good day doing affirmations, because when I don't know, I just find it's more of a dialogue for me with the wisest part of myself. That's the way I look at it.
Yeah.
And somebody else would think it's an elevated thing. I just feel like I've lost my way, and I can, there's an internal mechanism that seems very wise within me that when I can access it, it calms me down.
Yeah. You know, that's how I felt.
I don't know what that is.
Yeah, that's how I felt on Saturday when I was hearing all these things that I'd heard, you know, throughout my life that I hadn't heard lately. You know, the certain things that they say at Mass. I found it oddly comfortable. And I did the thing where I was looking around and seeing the people who didn't know where to stand or when to stand or when to sit down. And I felt a little superior, you know, having been a Catholic.
You knew the whole gimmick.
I knew.
But you know, when you're in pain, it's funny. When you're having a good day, sometimes the Mass or... But when my brother died and my dad died, and I knew when to stand and when to kneel, the ritual of that for me, even though I don't go to the church and I don't have a connection to the dogma of it and, you know, all the political reasons why you wouldn't go to the Catholic Church, but the smell, the connection to my family, the connection to what I grew up with, like I've made peace with that is part of me. I can't outrun it, you know? And I used to hate that part of me. I said I'm a failed agnostic because, like, I couldn't not believe in something. And I thought maybe it's just more like what my Buddhist friend said is take refuge in something that comforts you. And it doesn't mean you're going to go to Mass now from now on, but it is a nice memory, that part of it, you know? That's for me anyway. Trying to find our comfort. I think we're so... prone to trying to figure everything out intellectually, sometimes we kind of try to do an intellectual or a bypass, you know, I'll just get over into where I know the answer, you know.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter how you get there. I mean, some people do it through breathing and meditation. But I think those first 10 years of your life shape a lot of how you think.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah, I heard a really good line was from, you know, it takes your whole life to get over the first 10 years. And I was like, no wonder therapists are having money. And the other thing I was going to say is, one of the things, again, my books have a lot about the intellectual pursuit of answers. There's a joke I tell in the book, but it's a joke that I heard. If, you know, guy dies, goes to heaven, there's two doors. One says heaven, and one says lecture on heaven. And I love that.
Yeah.
That's me. I take the lecture first.
Yeah.
Just to make sure I wasn't in the wrong place.
Yeah.
And I think our intellect is so strong right now, it's not necessarily good, used for good all the time,
sure,
but I think we just have overdeveloped it so that we don't trust those little impulses, those little mystery moments. But I think people are trying to get back to that. And I don't think it's necessarily inside the walls of a church always. I think it might be, you know, whatever, you know, yoga or the humanist movement or, you know, having groups with people where they do things together, you know?
Yeah, a good walk too, right?
Pardon?
A good walk too helps, doesn't it?
Walking is 100% my practice. Like, I walk every day and someone says, oh, do you walk mindfully? I'm like, no, I just walk. That connection to my body and my, and also a lot of spiritual practices, you know, are to like kind of almost overcome the body, right? We don't make friends with the body, but walking is, I mean, it's such a good way to connect to the earth and where we live. And I said, just thousands of thoughts leave my brain as I'm walking, you know, just get rid of all that stress.
I can't tell you how much I enjoyed this book and talking to you today, especially.
I'm glad we connected.
Congratulations on this and good luck with it, because this is a book that I think people will need to read because they'll get entertained. They'll have a lot of laughs, but they'll walk away with something that I think they needed that they maybe even didn't think they needed. And so that's why I think it's an incredibly moving book. I so appreciate your time today, Deborah. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Oh, well, thank you for your time, and have a good day.
The book is called Shopping for God, A Comedian's Search for Meaning. It's published by Douglas and McIntyre. It's author Deborah Kimmett. Join me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunto.